for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The newspaper industry is in a free fall, but there are lots of questions about what it's going to look like when it lands. The old business model is broken. Many say it's the right time to push for a new mix of for-profit, low-profit, and non-profit news organizations to fill the void. Joining me in the studio to talk about inventing new business models for journalism, Leonard Downey. He's vice president at large, former executive editor of the Washington Post, and co-author of a new report from the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. It's titled The Reconstruction of American Journalism. And joining us by phone is Senator Ben Cardin, Democrat from Maryland. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Diane.
Len Downey, there's no question that the newspaper industry, the journal industry, as we know it, is losing business. What's really at risk here?
What's really at risk is particularly local reporting, local journalism, because there are many different kinds of news organizations covering national journalism, national affairs. But all across the country, in most cities, there was one newspaper covering the news. And most of those newsrooms are now half as large as they were before because the newspapers have lost roughly half their revenue during the last few years. And this is not just the recession. This is a what they call a secular change rather than a cyclical change, in that their advertising base is eroding. Much of it has gone to the internet, particularly classified advertising for jobs and houses and cars and so on that you can now find on the internet, often for free on places like Craigslist. And as a result, the economic model for these newspapers, as you said earlier, is broken. And as a result, their news gathering staffs are much smaller, and it means it's more difficult for them to cover the local news that people depend on across the country, and particularly what we call accountability reporting, the kinds of reporting about government and people with power in local communities that keeps them honest, that holds them accountable to the people in the community. And this is what we're worried about.
I know you make a number of recommendations in the report, but first I'd like to hear from Senator Ben Cardin. Senator Cardin, you recently introduced legislation to help struggling newspapers. Tell us about your proposals.
Well, Diane, I think Len has really laid out the problem correctly. Local news reporting is in deep trouble. It is the type of investigative reporting which is critically important to communities. The current model just does not work, and it's important for a democratic society to be able to have an independent local press. My legislation is an effort to preserve that independent local reporting by allowing a paper a choice. Newspaper could become a nonprofit. It would work for some. It may not be the course for all. But as a nonprofit, they would be able to get a new revenue source, and that would be local contributions, support from the local community. It would preserve its independence from government. I do not want to see government funds in local newspapers from the point of view of maintaining local objectivity. But it does allow a different model that may work in some communities where there's community support and understands the importance of having investigative local reporting.
Are you looking at a model much like that of national public radio and the support given to local stations like our own?
Not really, because, I mean, that's an important source. Don't get me wrong. It is a very, obviously, it's an important source. But public radio does get some government support. I am more interested in maintaining the local independence, but allowing local communities to support a local news organization. It's true that public radio, public television does receive public support because it is a nonprofit and it does work. But what I want to allow is a local newspaper organization to be able to choose to become a nonprofit.
How much support do you think there is for that kind of a model?
I really don't know, and that's been one of the challenges here. We know what's happening. We know that the newspapers are changing their way of doing business. They're closing. They're merging. What has not happened is the newspaper industry coming forward with new models that can work, and we're hoping that there'll be more forthcoming as to whether this nonprofit model is something that could work in communities around the country.
Len Downey, what do you think of that nonprofit model?
Well, as we speak, in fact, the good news is that a lot of smaller nonprofits are starting up all around the country. They're mostly online-only news organizations, so they do not have the heavy legacy costs of printing newspapers and delivering them door-to-door. So things like the Voice of San Diego in San Diego, the Min Post in Minneapolis, the St. Louis Beacon in St. Louis, these have been started actually by former journalists, former newspaper journalists. They're still journalists, but who had left newspapers and have started up these nonprofit news organizations with relatively small staffs, maybe a dozen people. But they focus on the kind of accountability coverage that the senator and I have been talking about.
But is the online only going to satisfy your concern, Senator Cardin?
Well, I'm concerned about maintaining investigative reporting and independent local reporting. I think, you know, I'd like to read a newspaper, the hard copy, but I think the reality of the market is that that's going to become a rarity, that you're going to see more and more of our news coming off the internet. So having the way that you disseminate the news to me is not as important as the ability to gather that news. And look, much of what's on the internet today is just rebroadcasting what comes out of our paper. But if we can get independent reporting through the internet, to me, that's fine.
Both you and Len Downey have emphasized local reporting. What about national, international reporting? Aren't you concerned equally about that, Senator?
Well, there seems to be plenty of competition for national and international investigative reporting. Currently today, there are many sources that are there to report on what's happening. I'm covered by what I do nationally. The problem is, as a United States senator, I'm not covered very well by the local papers. I am covered by the national papers.
Interesting. Do you agree with that, Len?
Yes, I do. I think that, and there are new models. We may discuss some of them later in this show, too, for national, international reporting as well. ProPublica in New York, for instance, which is supported by a big grant from a family in California and is seeking other funds. It's a nonprofit. It does investigative reporting all across the country, and it gives it away free to newspapers who then publish it. And that's a good thing. And there'll be more things like that.
So
as
that
well.
Comes in through a grant.
Yes. Okay. In this case, it's money from a family in California that believed, like the senator does, that something needs to be done to prop up newspaper reporting, and so they've given millions of dollars to ProPublica to start it, and now ProPublica is going to try to raise other money to supplant it.
Senator, I know you have to leave us, but how much support do you have within the Senate for this kind of legislation?
Well, I think there's substantial support to try to encourage different models to preserve our local reporting. So I think there is substantial support. The question is, can it coalesce around this model? The interesting point is that an organization today could become a nonprofit. It's just challenging with the IRS and still maintain advertising and subscription revenues. I think my bill clarifies that. It's right for some papers. It won't work for others. And I think support is growing.
So you think there is a long way to go then before we get to the model you're talking about?
Well, I think it's one option. I think there may be other options available, as Len has pointed out. I don't think we can wait much longer because we're losing a lot of capacity in this country.
Senator Ben Cardin, Democrat from Maryland, thank you so much for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
Thank you. Talk about some of these other models, Len Downey. You've talked about ProPublica and what's happening there. We're going to talk with a representative of ProPublica in just a moment, but I want to hear about some other models.
Right. All across the country, in many different communities, journalists have started up these nonprofit news organizations, most of which are published on the internet. And in some cases, they are partnering with local newspapers to provide them coverage that they might not otherwise have. This is also happening at the neighborhood level. In cities like Seattle, almost every neighborhood has a local neighborhood blog, news organization, started by a professional journalist, but with citizens contributing some of the news. That's another model. We at universities, we have some universities that have started up news organizations of their own. For instance, the University of Maryland has something called the Capital News Service that covers the state capitol for newspapers throughout Maryland. They're providing that news for newspapers that can't afford to get it another way anymore.
But the question always becomes, who's doing the writing? Who's doing the fact-checking?
Right. Now, these are run by professional journalists. Sometimes they have citizen contributors. Sometimes they have student reporters. But they're being run by professional journalists who make sure that it turns out to be credible reporting.
Are there layers?
Yes, there are layers. For instance, some of the professional journalists are on the faculties of the universities, which helps support the news organization. And there's the same kind of editing going on there that would go on at any news organization.
Interesting, because within my own local condominium community, we have a publication.
Right.
So, I mean, you do have these small organizations springing up. Not that they're going to go very far, right. But it's important to, I gather, the community in which they live.
Yes, and then you have larger neighborhood ones, and then you have city ones. You even have some state startups now. So our report, our recommendations in this report are designed to help that ecosystem, if you will, survive, to help these new startup organizations survive.
Leonard Downey, Vice President at Large, former executive editor of The Washington Post, co-author with Michael Shudson, professor of journalism at Columbia University, of the reconstruction of American journalism. And as we talk about what's happening to the newspaper industry, not only here in the United States, but worldwide, with Leonard Downey, former executive editor at the Washington Post, currently co-author of a new report from Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, entitled The Reconstruction of American Journalism. We're joined now by phone by Stephen Engelberg. He's managing editor of ProPublica. Good morning to you, Stephen.
Good morning.
Explain the concept behind ProPublica.
Well, the notion was that we were seeing, as Len mentioned, a real diminution in the ability of newspapers and other media, television and radio as well, to do the kind of watchdog reporting that we think society needs. And so the Sandlers, Herbert Marion Sandler, the California family that Len mentioned, put on the table a very generous grant of some $10 million a year, which they pledged for multiple years to get this organization going. And so we have been able to hire more than 20 reporters and various editors and other kinds of support people. And we have gone out to do investigative stories which make a difference, you know, stories with what we call moral force. And the concept is that we share them not only with newspapers, but with radio, television, internet,
We have had more than 100 partnerships so far, and our stories go out for free, which is a pretty good price for a lot of these media outlets.
Now, we've just gotten an email, and it's from Joanne, who says, "Caution, ProPublica has an agenda, left wing, supported by Herb Sandler. I've seen biased stories coming out of this organization, picked up by the national media without any investigation into where they came from, why they're being pushed, or how accurate they are. Please understand," she says, "I'm a Democrat, but I don't support bias on either side." How do you respond, Stephen?
Well, first of all, I don't support bias on either side either. My background for your listeners is that I spent 18 years at the New York Times completing work there as its first investigative editor. I was then a managing editor of the Oregonian and Portland, Oregon, which is a pretty fair newspaper. And I came to this job, as did my boss, the editor-in-chief of ProPublica, the former editor of the Wall Street Journal, Paul Steiger, who retired after 16 years in that job. Both Paul and I came here with the understanding that there would be no editorial interference of any kind by anybody involved with the funding of this organization, and we have that both, as a personal assurance and in writing from the board. And I can assure Joanne that, in fact, there is no particular agenda to our work beyond the agenda set by the journalists here. It's interesting, when we began, we sort of were up and running at the tail end of the Bush administration, and people said, "There you go, left-wing agenda, you're very critical of the Bush administration," because, of course, it's the natural thing of investigative journalists to be critical of those in power. And when the Obama administration came in and we continued to criticize mistakes by the government and point them out and expose things, we began getting emails saying that you're actually quite right-wing because you're not letting this very fine liberal Democratic president and hit the Congress make the changes that are needed. And the truth of the matter is that as an organization, we are in favor of exposing abuses of power, either by companies, state government, local government, federal government, and it really doesn't matter who's doing it. What matters is the effect it has on people.
Now, I understand that you got the grant of $10 million a year for the first 3 years, and that the fourth year has just been funded. What happens after 5 years?
Well, there's several things going on. As Len mentioned, we are in the midst of, frankly, at the Sandler's urging as well as our own, trying to diversify the funding here. And we've gotten a very generous grant from the Knight Foundation to go out and begin to address some of the problems that have been referred to earlier in this show, which is that if you're going to be a nonprofit entity, what kind of model can work? And so we are now looking at a variety of different means of fundraising. That would include foundations, philanthropy by others, and also some of the other models. I think the NPR model of getting a little money from a lot of people certainly, to my mind, could be quite attractive. It certainly gives you a base of support and interest in what you're doing.
How realistic would you say it is, too, that a number of large foundations out there would be willing to support you?
Well, we certainly have gotten a lot of interest. I think the story, with the help of people of the sort of prominence of Len Downey and others, the story that we have a problem in the world of media is now becoming one that I think a large group of people understand. And I don't think that the solution will be entirely in the area of philanthropy or nonprofits. I think the businesses that are still trying to make a go of this are going to have to come up with a better business model, but it certainly could be part of the answer. And I think if you're a foundation and you're interested in the sorts of things foundations are interested in, like social justice, like transparency of government, funding a nonprofit journalistic organization can be a very effective means of achieving those goals.
You heard Senator Cardin talk about his proposal looking for nonprofit, the establishment of nonprofit local news organizations. What's your reaction?
Well, I think that every sort of piece of the puzzle helps. I do like to point out that nonprofit, which we are, does not mean nonsensical in the sense of spending more money than you have. So the sort of issue remains, can we create organizations that are sustainable in some way or another. One of the things that defines the current organizations that are springing up, and there are a number of them, you know, you have in San Diego something called the Voice of San Diego, as an example, a very, very interesting, robust new organization only online covering San Diego. The salaries that organizations like that can pay tend to be very low. And so you can attract basically either, I suppose, well-heeled young people or young people whose needs, you know, don't extend as far as, you know, sort of more mature people with families and so on. So, you know, the current journalism that existed up to this point, say the Washington Post, one could make a viable sort of comfortably middle-class living working in a newspaper or a magazine or in radio and television. That at the moment in these new things would be much less true. So I think, you know, over time we have to get to a point where, at least you'd want to, where you can employ more than just very, very young people. Because, you know, the diversity of a newsroom is one of its strengths. You want all ages, all backgrounds, all sorts of people.
What about that, Len? That is paying good people.
Right. Steve touches on a very important point. That's one of the reasons why in this report we are recommending a number of ways to help fund these nonprofit journalism organizations so that they can grow. He mentions the Voice of San Diego. They have a very disciplined plan in which they're going to try to grow their funding year after year so that as those very promising young journalists grow older, they're able to pay them higher salaries. It's also why we recommend universities doing more journalism themselves, because they're able to pay faculty-level salaries to journalists who've left newspapers and can do journalism under the roof of a university.
All right, and we're joined now by Philip Balboni. He is founder of Global Post. Good morning to you, Philip.
Good morning, Diane.
You Very are. Nice to be with you. I'm glad you're with us as well. You are, I gather, a passionate believer in for-profit journalism. Talk about why.
I am. I think it's tremendously important, particularly now with all of the focus and attention on nonprofit journalism and government support, that we not lose sight of the fact that for 200 or more years of our history, commercial journalism has brought us the news, some of it wonderful and others not so much so, but it is what has sustained us. Now, of course, we're in a transformative time. Things are changing, and the fortunes of the traditional commercial news enterprises are not looking good, and it is quite appropriate to be worried and to look for alternatives.
But of course, this morning's Washington Post is reporting that Gannett's profit, Gannett, which operates USA Today, has plummeted some 53%.
Yes.
So considering what's happening there in the for-profit area, how do you explain the Global Post business model?
Well, you know, it's such a profound difference, Diane, because we have had the opportunity to start at the beginning to build Global Post around the internet, which is a phenomenal distribution technology and allows you to publish at much less expense. But we tried to think ahead about how to support our journalism, and so we've built three different revenue streams: advertising, of course, on the site, the syndication for cash of our original content to newspapers and websites and television and radio networks in the U.S. and overseas. And our recent agreement with CBS News was a great example of that. And lastly, we have a paid membership service called Passport, which is really one of the most exciting and innovative things that we're doing to build our business. And we give individuals who are interested in what's happening in the world exclusive content and special benefits that are unique and exciting in exchange for a modest annual fee. Mm-hmm. And this is really, I think, at the cutting edge of where we need to be, whether you're a traditional or a new media enterprise, to support quality journalism. We need to find ways to engage consumers.
But didn't the Wall Street Journal try that and have to rescind its charge?
No, I think you're thinking back to the New York Times, which started something called Times Select about 5 years ago and decided to stop. But the Wall Street Journal is phenomenally successful with its paid subscription model, both print and online. And you've probably heard or read quotes from Mr. Murdoch that he intends to have all of the News Corporation properties charge online.
Philip Balboni, he's founder of Global Post, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Phil, another question. How successful has Global Post been thus far?
We have been blessed with really amazing success, Diane. We have built an exceptional team, and the content is much stronger than I could have ever hoped for, with 74 correspondents in some 50 countries. The audience base for our site has wildly exceeded our expectations. More than 2.5 million people have visited Global Post since we launched in mid-January. In September, we reached the level of 500,000 people coming to our site. All of the revenue streams that I mentioned are operating successfully, and we just had our fall board of directors meeting last week, approved our budget for 2010, and we're projecting that we will be profitable in 2012.
All right, Lynn Downey has a comment.
A couple things to say about Phil's. I think this is his, what he's experimenting with is very important. There do need to be new models for profitable news gathering as well as nonprofit. Two things that are really important about this that he's taking advantage of. One is that most of his correspondents are part time. So he's not having to pay full-time salaries.
What about benefits?
And you'll have to ask him about
right.
that. But then the other thing is he's essentially allowing news organizations to outsource foreign coverage, which is a good thing since they can't afford foreign correspondents of their own. But this is what you're seeing increasingly in the industry, is that before individual newspapers and news organizations were completely self-sufficient, and now they can't be any longer. So they're cooperating with each other in ways that they never did before, getting investigative reporting from ProPublica, getting foreign correspondence from Global Post. You know, these are good developments, but it's not the usual traditional model where everything's being paid for by the news organization out of its own revenue.
And Steve Engelberg, any comment?
Well, a couple of things. I do agree with Len that that's what we're seeing here. I think foreign coverage is a particularly tricky area. Global Post is a great addition, but it doesn't make up by any means for what has been lost here, because it is so expensive to do foreign coverage and, frankly, so dangerous that the field is being increasingly left to, you know, a very small number of players. And, you know, we ourselves, we can cover things all over the world, are, you know, very reluctant to, say, send a correspondent to Afghanistan. Your listeners may be aware the New York Times had one correspondent kidnapped. Two correspondents kidnapped, one of whom was rescued in a hail of bullets that left some people dead, another of whom very fortuitously was able to escape. We don't have the kind of infrastructure, even with the money the sailors are provided, to have security and armored cars and all the rest of it. So I think this is a very serious issue. Foreign coverage is what we need as citizens to know what is happening, an important thing such as, you know, the Afghanistan debate, and I think there's less of it now than there's ever been.
That's a very good point. The Washington Post and the New York Times are among the few news organizations that still maintain full bureaus in Iraq and send correspondents regularly into Afghanistan.
And
it costs millions of dollars.
And NPR.
And it costs, yes, thank you. And it costs millions of dollars and is a constant worry about safety. And you need large news organizations to do that, news organizations of the size of NPR, the New York Times, or the Washington Post. And there are fewer and fewer of them, and that's a big worry.
And Phil Bill Balboni, going back to this question about how you pay your correspondents, are they, for the most part, part-time? Oh, dear. How'd we lose Phil Balboni? All right. Well, we'll hope to get him back and to explore the various means in which people are paid, what kinds of benefits there are, what kinds of fact-checking there is. And in our next segment, we'll be joined by Arianna Huffington, editor-in-chief of The Huffington Post. And, of course, we'll take your calls. Join us on 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age, by the Gruber Family Foundation to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
A world without ice. A geophysicist explains why climate change could result in the loss of all the Earth's glaciers after 2030, why polar ice caps are melting, and how to cope with environmental changes ahead. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we'll open our phones in just a moment. First, here's a question from Gail, an email from Burke, Virginia. She says, a question for Mr. Downey. I'm alarmed to hear that some believe hard copy newspapers will not survive and be a thing of the past. We are all not 20-somethings who get their news from the internet. I subscribe to the Washington Post 7 days a week.
Good for you.
Very much looking forward to reading it every morning. What's your view of the survival and viability of the hard copy?
Yes, I hard copy newspapers are not going to disappear. I know there are a lot of internet.
You promise?
I promise.
Okay.
I know a lot of internet people say that, but that's not what's happening. There are 1,400 daily newspapers in the country, and within the last year, maybe half a dozen have gone out of business or gone only onto the internet. There will be others that will disappear, but there are going to still be hundreds of newspapers left in the country in print form. The question is, what kind of news are they going to be able to provide their readers? I believe that we at at the Washington Post are going to be able to still provide a really good newspaper for our readers. But we're a larger news organization with a larger revenue than some of these smaller papers around the country that are surviving with really small news staffs. And the question is, how well can they cover their communities? And don't we need other news organizations in those communities to supplement or compete with what they're doing?
And we're joined now by Arianna Huffington. She's editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post. Good morning to you, Arianna.
Good morning, Diane. Great to be with you.
Good to hear your voice. What would you say your experience with the Huffington Post tells you and us about the future business models for journalism?
Well, of course, you know, I appreciate all the issues that you have been raising and the concerns. I just feel that we need to change the debate from saving newspapers to saving journalism. And at the Huffington Post, the way we are doing our small part for that is to launch a Huffington Post Investigative Fund, which is supported by foundations as well as by the Huffington Post. In fact, our investigative editor is somebody Len knows well, Larry Roberts, who came from the Washington Post.
Yes.
And at the same time, to be using our community through our Eyes and Ears project to be feeding information from all around the country. The problems are major, but I don't think they can be solved by going back to the past and pretending that the technological advances that have changed consumer habits have not happened.
I totally agree with that, Arianna, and the report makes that very clear. We're talking about saving news reporting regardless of the medium and regardless of how it's done and who it's done by. And in fact, citizen involvement in journalism of a kind that you've pioneered is very important to the future of journalism.
But now, what about this for-profit, non-for-profit idea, Arianna? Where are you on that?
Well, I'm very much in favor of a hybrid for-profit, not-for-profit. I think getting foundations involved, the way the Knight Foundation has been involved, including at the local level that Len has been talking about, also looking at what ProPublica is doing, that's a model which I think has tremendous appeal because it retains the objectivity of journalism. It retains a sort of it deals with the concerns about conflicts of interest, and provides a lot of resources from people who care about this very important resource in our public life.
All right, let's open the phones now while we have you all on. Philip Balboni, he's founder of Global Post. Stephen Engelberg, managing editor of ProPublica, and Arianna Huffington of the Huffington Post, as well as Leonard Downey of Columbia University. Let's go first to Dick, who's in Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Diane. I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I just had two comments and a question. The two reasons mainly that we have stopped newspapers in my household is that we feel the reporting is negative and sensational. And the second reason is that it's shallow and safe, maybe even cowardly. And so with those two things, there's not much incentive to go after even a professional paper. What we do now is we take The Economist. We find that to be not that way. It's objective. So I'm just wondering, is that in anybody's periscope, or doesn't anybody see that? Am I the only one?
Steve Engelberg.
Yes. Well, our experience at the Oregonian was that the perception that the paper was biased was one of the leading reasons that people canceled. I think the leading reason was the fact that it piled up and nobody read it, and so that's another kind of problem. But I think newspapers have to be very, very aware that we are in a period of history in which people have very strong and very informed opinions, and I think you have to be very aware of how your paper might appear. And, you know, we certainly at the Oregonian were working very hard to not have the newspaper, frankly, reflect one view or another. And, you know, sometimes these things are not even conscious. I don't think any reporter sets out to be biased, at least no really professional one, but it can happen. And it's the job of the editors, I think, to provide some kind of ballast.
Phil Balboni.
Well, I think the caller's viewpoints reflect part of this enormous transformation that we're seeing, that people, because primarily of the Internet and because of their own dissatisfaction with many of the things that have been delivered to them, are searching for new alternatives. And I think that this presents an additional challenge. We have the economic challenges that are becoming increasingly well known, and we've lost the support of many of our readers or listeners or viewers, and I think we have to confront that head on. And I think that that is why, if we can make many new enterprises flower in the journalism landscape, that we will give people more choice and we'll give them the opportunity to find whatever it is that they are seeking informationally.
Winter Park, Colorado. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning. I have a question about the local newspapers that we have one in Miami, the free papers that seem to support themselves with advertising. In Miami, it's the New Times. In the summer, I live in Winter Park, Colorado, and there's two of those papers here. I don't know the names of them now, but they're very useful in terms of local information, and some of them have syndicated things like, well, I don't think the names, but anyway.
Where yeah, sure. Ariana, how about the Huffington Post? How does it address the local issues?
Well, we've actually just recently launched a Denver section, which was our third local section, Chicago and New York having preceded it, and Los Angeles is going to follow next month. And what we're doing in each of these cities and surrounding areas is both aggregate news and also make partnerships with a lot of local sites, local newspapers, to take a lot of the content and increase the distribution and linking back to them, of course, and have a great collection of local bloggers ranging from politicians to activists and of course, once again, our citizen journalism projects. One quick thing also to address the previous question. There is a lot of legitimate dissatisfaction about journalism generally because many journalists miss the two biggest stories of our time. With a few very honorable exceptions, journalists miss the economic meltdown and the lead up to the war in Iraq. So part of what we need to do is not just save journalism, but strengthen it and have a lot more biopsies and fewer autopsies, which is what we've been having in the last few years.
All right, Huffington, she's editor-in-chief of The Huffington Post, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning, Charles. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Love your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to touch more on government involvement with the media in general. You had the senator on previously suggesting introducing legislation to help out struggling newspapers. And while I think it may be attractive for some news organizations to consider government funding or involvement, I think that they should resist that temptation and try to somehow stand alone. And on another front, this recent dust-up with the Obama administration over Fox News and them categorizing them as a non-news entity, I think that concerns me. And I think that other news outlets, such as Ariana's, should raise their voice. Even though the ideologies conflict, I think that when an administration can pick and choose a news organization, what is and what is not, it could be somebody else down the line. And I think that some, there should be more of an outcry.
All right. Len Downey, what's your reaction?
Well, I'll address the first part of that question. I avoid politics. What the senator is proposing is not government funding for newspapers,
right,
but legislation or even the IRS could do it in a ruling that makes it clear that any news organization could become a nonprofit and accept charitable donations and operate in many ways like a nonprofit. So that's not really government. That's not government paying newspapers. However, at the same time, government has been involved through the Corporation of Public Broadcasting in public radio and television. It doesn't control them at all. It merely provides money that goes through an independent organization, the Corporation of Public Broadcasting. It does exactly the same thing with the National Institutes of Health for medical research, with the National Science Foundation for science research, with the National Endowments for the Arts and Humanities for cultural advancement. And so what we're proposing in this report is that you might be able to set up a similar organism, independent of government control, but with some government money that could fund innovations in news coverage of the kind that a number of our guests have been talking about today, that need the seed money in order to try to experiment with new business models.
Phil Balboni, what about this dust-up, as our caller labeled it, between the Obama administration and Fox News?
Yes, I'll take that on, Diane. I think that it reflects a disturbing trend in journalism on television in particular, which is that we have four national news networks, two of which at least are perceived as having taken a particular ideological perspective on the news. I know they dispute that, but that is widely perceived to be true, and the administration feels that Fox News is not fair to them and is not going to be, so they choose not to talk to them. I think I agree with the caller that it's probably tactically, if not philosophically, not the right approach. But I think it grows out of a change in journalism that is, I find, continued to be very disturbing.
Steve Engelberg, do you want to comment?
Well, I agree. I think that we are seeing a trend here that is disturbing. But let's be clear. I think Len could speak to this. Whether the White House officially announces it or not, there has long been in Washington a sense in every administration that certain media are more friendly than others.
Correct.
And so this is not, in one sense, a new trend. I think the sort of overt, direct conversation about it, which maybe is healthy, is new. Let's not kid ourselves.
Right. That's a good point. There have been times when various administrations, both Republican and Democratic,
have denied that there was any problem.
Right. But meanwhile, have gone through back channels to make clear that they don't want to talk to certain reporters, or in some cases even tried to get me to take reporters out of the White House. And so that does go on. But this is unusual that this is a very public fight. And the thing that I will add, because it's not really about politics, is that, of course, part of what we're talking about here is ratings. There's a ratings war going on amongst the cable networks, and the more reaction Fox gets out of the White House, I think the more they think their ratings are going to go up.
All right, let's go now to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Good morning, Robbie. Quick question, please.
My quick question, Diane, is your guest mentioned earlier that the pay subscription model at the New York Times had failed while the pay subscription model at the Wall Street Journal had been successful. My question is, why?
I think the main difference there is that the Wall Street Journal, like the Financial Times, which also has a successful pay subscription model, is that they provide information for business people and others that's actionable, information that you will be willing to pay for as opposed to just general news. What the New York Times did was put their most popular columnists behind a paywall, and people got unhappy about that. They did not want to pay to read Maureen Dowd because they just don't think that's what happens with columnists, as opposed to a lot of data and analysis about business that business people will pay the Wall Street Journal or the Financial Times for.
So going forward, do you see lots of newspapers around the country publishing both an online newspaper as well as hard copy.
That's exactly what they're doing, and we're able to experiment more online because the capacity online is infinite, whereas there's only so much capacity on the printed page, and you can do all sorts of things that involve your audience in your news in ways that, for instance, the Huffington Post is pioneering. So you'll see a lot more of that, and you will see experimentation with news organizations trying to charge for certain kinds of news that they develop that would have special interest to an audience that would be willing to pay for it, of the kind that Phil Balboni is talking about the Global Post doing.
Leonard Downey, Vice President at Large, former executive editor of The Washington Post, co-author with Michael Shudson of a Columbia University report titled The Reconstruction of American Journalism, Stephen Engelberg, managing editor of ProPublica, and Phil Balboni, founder of Global Post. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.